welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge Muncie community. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Jacob Boston. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Mark Denley's story on food and water watch protests. Manchin climate side deal. Then, Moses review, Huron Valley Community College travel budget. Later on, Future of Small Cities Institute tells us about their upcoming programming, including an event on waterfront cities and a film screening. After that, Arm of the Sea Theater tells Andrea Cunliffe about their show, Dirt, The Secret Life of Soil. That will take place at Freedom Square at the Sanctuary on October 8th. Finally, Lee Strimbeck brings us news on theater, on the theater world in the region, and discusses barriers to making theater accessible for more people. But first, here are the headlines.
New Yorkers carry the fourth highest household debt in the country, and their average debt is on the rise. While the average household debt of $53,830 is slightly below the national average, several individual debt categories, like student loans and credit card debit, are much higher than the national rate.
The crossings of Colony Waterfront will be temporarily closed to the public following the discovery of several sick and deceased waterfowl by the park's pond. The animals are being tested to determine the cause of death.
And according to News 10, the summer of 2022 was rattled with gun violence in the capital region cities, especially Albany, Schenectady, and Troy. Overall, gun violence in these cities has increased in 2022 when compared to 2021.
That is it for the headlines.
And for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital region through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you could contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
So first up, when Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer got Senator Manchin to agree to pass a climate funding bill, he agreed to a side deal to attach a bill to weaken oversight of fossil fuel projects to the resolution and to continue operating the federal government. To date, more than 400 scientists released a letter imploring Congress to reject the deal, and leaders of 13 national environmental groups were arrested for blockading the interest to the United States Senate. Thomas Mayer, National Organizing Manager of Food and Water Watch, talks with Mark Denley here.
We're joined by Thomas Mayer, who is the National Organizing Manager for Food and Water Watch. And like many climate change groups, they've been very concerned and opposed to the so-called side deal that Senator Schumer agreed to with Senator Manchin of West Virginia in exchange for passing the Inflation Reduction Act. And just recently, Sandra Steingramer and other 400 plus scientists released a letter. So Thomas, can you bring us up to date? What's going on with this side deal?
Yeah, so we knew as of a couple months ago, back in July, that Schumer and Manchin had struck this deal essentially to fast track fossil fuel projects, pipelines especially, and to really truncate it and weaken the public review and community review process that applies to most major infrastructure projects in the country under the rules of the National Environmental Policy Act and the Clean Water Act and other laws. It was just yesterday, that being Wednesday, September 21st, that the text of Manchin's bill was released. But we have been, you know, working with allies, like I said, for the last couple of months to publicly oppose this, to organize against this. And so many members of Congress have already spoken out, both in the House and the Senate, saying that this is an unacceptable deal. And we basically confirmed with the release of Manchin's text that it would shorten the public review process. It would take decisions out of the hands of permitting agencies and courts in some cases. In the case of the Mountain Valley Pipeline, it would essentially just require by act of Congress that massive 300-mile frack gas pipeline be approved. So it's really a disaster, and it sets up this this next week between now and September 30th as the key stage in this fight to stop this deal.
Now, I understand on Thursday, leaders of 13 environmental groups, including Food and Water Watch, Sunrise Movement, New York Communities for Change, and Center for Biological Diversity, blocked the entrance to the, the Senate building, particularly trying to call on Senator Schumer. Senator Schumer, I made a deal, I'm going to live by my deal, and he's apparently going to try to attach the so-called side deal to what's called a must-have-to-pass bill, probably the bill to require the federal government to keep government running. So a lot of Congress people have come out, not our own Congress member Paul Tonko, but a lot of other Congress members from New York that said they're opposed to the deal. What are the prospects for actually getting a real vote up and down and defeating this thing?
Yeah, so the up or down vote next week will be on the bill to fund the government. Basically, they call it a continuing resolution. It's basically a short-term funding bill that is passed sort of as needed, and the deadline for that is the end of the day on the 30th. The permitting provisions put forward by Senator Manchin will either be included in that deal or they won't be. We of course are pushing for them to not be included. I don't think anybody wants a government shutdown. It's incredibly disruptive to millions of people and federal employees, which are, not just members of Congress, but actually hundreds of thousands of honest, hardworking people around the country. That should be avoided. But the cost of keeping the government open, should not come at the expense of communities that are facing the harms of the fossil fuel industry and these other dangerous infrastructure projects. So what we've heard from many members of Congress is, don't make us choose between one bad thing and another. Pushing the leadership of both houses to have a clean vote. That will play out over the next few days. Like you said, the action today was aimed at members of the Senate and making sure that there are not enough votes to move forward with a bill that would implement some of these proposals from Senator Manchin to really weaken environmental reviews.
So what can community members do between now and when the continuing resolution comes up? As I said, Congressman Tonko not been willing to say no to it. Obviously, Elaine Stefanik, not sure what the new Congress member who replaced Delgado is saying. Obviously, Senator Schumer is the majority leader in New York, from New York State, actually running for re-election. But anything that local people can do to express their concerns at this point?
Yeah, I'd say everyone in New York should absolutely call Senator Gillibrand. That is not a lost cause. We don't have super great intelligence on her position on this, but she's definitely heard from people. Our organizer talked to her at a town hall a few weeks ago. So everybody should make their concerns known to Senator Gillibrand and to their member of Congress in the House. Whether that's making a phone call, showing up at their district office, finding them at a town hall or a local event over the weekend. That's the most important thing, is that they hear from constituents, they hear from organizations in their state and in their district.
And how overall is the effort to, deal with climate change going? We hear the IRA recently passed was the single largest funding bill ever for climate. Is Congress doing the job that they need to be doing?
They're really not. I mean, the metric of quote unquote largest climate investment ever is a poor one. It's a very, very low bar to clear, considering Congress has largely not done anything about climate previously. So, you know, in the sense that they weren't doing anything and now they did something, that is encouraging. And it shows that the climate movement and all of our allies and all of the people who have been, you know, pushing for climate action of some kind over many years are having some success. We're still clearly running up against Senator Manchin primarily, and the power that the fossil fuel industry does have over, you know, just a handful of members of Congress. But there's still a lot that can be done. We heard that President Biden was considering declaring a climate emergency and unleashing some of his executive authority by doing so. And there's still a lot more that the president can do, you know, via his existing executive authority. So people should absolutely, you know, keep up the fight at both the federal level and at the state and local level. But we got to start by stopping this deal.
And we've been talking with Thomas Meyer, National Organizing Manager, Food and Water Watch website.
Yeah, foodandwaterwatch.org.
And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
A reminder that if you are interested in voicing your opinion on climate funding, the bill is due to be voted upon in Congress by the end of September.
In the last year, uncertainty and questions have been swirling around Hudson Valley Community College's president, Roger Ramsamy. He has pursued an aggressive campaign to forge international links and add international revenue to the college. However, his frequent travel in pursuits of this has come under scrutiny, as have some of his other decisions. Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Moses Nagel reports.
Cindy Doran, the deputy minority leader of the Rensselaer County Legislature from Troy, sits on the Education Committee. As the committee was preparing to review and pass the $91 million budget for Hudson Valley Community College over the summer, she received some strange reports.
I had constituents reach out to me because they saw a Facebook post by the chairman of the Hudson Valley Board of Trustees, Neil Kelleher's wife, went on a trip to Israel with other people from the college, including the president, Dr. Ramsamy. And the trip was a trip of a lifetime. And you see all kinds of pictures from Israel. And so constituents were very concerned about this. So during the July education meeting, a representative from Hudson Valley, the CFO, spoke on a few resolutions that we would have to pass out of committee. And at the end, I just brought up the topic of this Facebook post and the concern that some constituents had. And then there's been talk from other people wondering about all kinds of international travel that Dr. Ramsamy has made, typically taking the chair of the Board of Trustees and other people with him. So I asked about that, and I said, I'm a little concerned because next week we have to vote on the Hudson Valley budget, and we don't really know a lot about the travel expenses, and we've tried to find some line items that would indicate where the president may have gone and where the funding was from and who went on the trip, and I'd like that information before we vote on the budget next week. So I was very specific about what I requested, and I put that in email form at a later date. I wanted to know about his international travel, Dr. Ramsamy's, the dates and the locations and the purpose of the trip, as well as any expenses associated with the travel. And then I wanted to know the return on this investment from these different travel experiences that the president was taking. So the CFO was, you know, he was very positive about this and said he would get back to me with the information I requested. So I followed up the following week, the Monday before our Tuesday meeting, and just sent a reminder out to him indicating that I had not heard back from him and that it was important that we have this information prior to the meeting. We needed to spend time looking at it. We knew there was going to be a budget vote. Well, after I sent him the email, someone from the college sent a message to me indicating that my request was going to be considered part of Freedom for Information Law, known as FOIL, and that they would let me know by the end of July whether they're going to grant my request for information. Now, this information has to do with a budget that the legislature votes on, and we are a large sponsor of Hudson Valley. We're also great supporters, and we believe that it is a gem in our county. At Tuesday's meeting, our caucus talked ahead of the meeting and said, we don't have this important information. We're being denied it. And how can we support the budget without the information we need? So during the meeting, when this resolution came up for a vote, I did ask if we could table the motion for a month. Our colleagues on the other side voted the motion down. So that means we had to vote on the resolution as it stood at that meeting. And so the six of us voted no because we didn't have the information we needed. And I guess that caused, you know, a slight problem. The county executive, you know, didn't like that. Wasn't unanimous, but it's reasonable. And, you know, we're here to represent the taxpayers, the people of Troy and the rest of the county.
As a result of the Democratic caucus's no vote, representatives of the school reached out and promised to provide the documentation the legislature had been asking for.
We agreed that we'd be very happy to meet once we had the information requested. And we had a chance to look at it and ask questions. So prior to the August committee meeting, so that would be the first week in August, we were in caucus, and that evening an envelope was delivered to me, and I believe the other education committee legislators, but I can't tell you for sure. And in this envelope is quite a bit of documentation from Dr. Ramsamy. He goes into detail about why he traveled to a number of countries, who the participants were, and what the purpose was. But we really don't have the individual costs for any of this travel. We get a total budget that was, you know, reported in the Times Union, but I don't have the information that I requested. I wanted to know what was spent on each one of these international travel trips and who was paying for other people to attend and how much all of that cost. I know in some cases, for example, we were told that Neil Kelleher's wife paid for her own trip. Okay, that's fine. But we don't have outcomes. We don't have the expenses in line with the trip. And I certainly don't have the return, the rate of return. Like, was it worth spending that kind of money, you know, to go to, let's say, Costa Rica.
There's Costa Rica also, and Norway.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of travel in here, but Denmark, Sweden, yes, that's in here. I believe he gave me the report for domestic and international, and I counted 8 different international trips, and he actually took more because I've received confirmation from outside sources. That's fine. But I did not get the answers that we requested that deal with the budget. It's the bottom line. Got a lot of paper, and, you know, that's great. There's been no follow-up from the president.
The president's office has since acknowledged that this year's travel budget is $137,000, with $186,000 slated for next year. Soon after this, the president's office announced that COVID vaccines would not be mandatory for the fall semester. This was not in keeping with the state university policy, which HVCC is supposed to follow. There was dissent to this policy from students and faculty. The SUNY-wide student assembly denounced the president's position. Mr. Ann also serves on the health committee of the Rensselaer County Legislature.
I mean, I received a lot of calls and a lot of contacts, as well as I've spoken with board members who were not aware of this and did not have a role in that decision. And, you know, the media indicated that the county was involved. I asked Mary Fran Wachunas, who's the director of public health, if she was consulted. She said no. I asked Kelly Hoffman, the chairwoman, and her leadership at a committee meeting if they were involved. They said no. So I have to assume that it's the county executive and his administration who was advising Dr. Ramsamy. I stood up last night at our regular monthly meeting and spoke during legislative privilege and said that the county does not have a role in advising the college on following SUNY protocol, and what an embarrassment it was for all of us in the county, and a disappointment. It really did anger me as a retired teacher that we can give the message to others, including students, that it's okay, you know, to defy policy, that we're going to be the school out of 64 that says, you know, we don't have to follow the vaccine policy.
Eventually, the administration adjusted the position to be in line with the rest of SUNY, which requires COVID vaccines. But because of this decision, the HVCC Faculty Association was considering a no-confidence vote on President Ramsamy's leadership. I reached out to the president's office and the board of directors for comment on this story, but have not received a response as of airtime. Hudson Mohawk Magazine will keep you informed as this story develops. This is Moses Nagel.
And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea Conliffe.
And I'm Jacob Austin. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Choi, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Choi, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, and WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
And if you like what you hear, you can support this program by telling a friend. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
For the wader enthused, especially those who love the Hudson River, this next story is about upcoming programming that focuses on waterfront cities in a and a film screening about the schooner Apollonia.
Welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Rafe Larson. You're here to tell us about two interesting events that your organization, Future of Small Cities Institute, has coming up. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me again. Always lovely to be here. Yeah, so we have two really exciting events, and both of these coincide with our current exhibition that's at the Focus Lab, which is on Hudson waterfronts. And that exhibit is wrapping up at the end of October. So if you haven't seen it yet, definitely go check it out. So the first event is on Tuesday, September 27th at 6 p.m. And we've invited a really cool group of folks who work and live in the Hudson Valley and have been instrumental in activating their waterfronts. So this is the eternal challenge for cities, right? Is first you have to develop the waterfront, and this often has involved like transforming these waterfronts from derelict industrial polluted spaces to recreational spaces, to park spaces, to, you know, provide accessibility to your citizens. But that's really just sort of the first step, because you have to almost retrain people to think about the river as a place that you would want to go, that you would want to be, that you would want to hang around and be around other people. So there's a whole layer of activation, which has to do with programming, which has to do with partnerships and collaborations. So, for instance, a really good example of this is Adam Weinert, who's one of the founders of the Hudson Arts Coalition, was instrumental in bringing about Waterfront Wednesdays, which goes on every Wednesday in the city of Hudson during the warmer months, and features like guest artists and puppetry and dancing, music. And it's a really diverse crowd that comes down to the waterfront. There's a lot of boats there that offer boat rides, kayaking, all kinds of things like that.
Oh, interesting. The waterfront takes place in Hudson.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I was just there and it felt like this is a space that has so much potential but is separated by the train station and it wasn't really utilized. This was for the Latinx festival that just happened. So in Hudson specifically, with that railroad, what is the obstacle there?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple obstacles down there. And, you know, there's a sort of almost like a breaker. The railroad is one of them, but there's like a kind of break space between the downtown Hudson and the waterfront itself. So this Waterfront Wednesdays was one of the ways to get people down there and have an excuse to go down there. And I think the question of accessibility, which is one certainly that is very on the mind in Albany, right, where you have a giant highway sort of blocking waterfront access for many people, is big. And I think to surmount obstacles like that, you have to have reasons for people to come down. One, you have to make it easy, and two, you have to make it seem like it's worth it. So all these cities have these challenges. Julie Noble, who's the sustainability coordinator for the city of Kingston, they've done a ton of work around Kingston Point Park, which is another one of these kind of formerly industrial spaces that has been really activated. They have a comprehensive waterfront plan called Weaving the Waterfront, where they've done a lot of outreach. I think one of the challenges about waterfronts in general is that every municipality has their own sort of set of plans. And it's hard to have a sort of regional approach to the waterfront, even though watersheds are regional by definition, right? The ecosystem doesn't know any municipal boundaries. So really, we should be planning regionally and kind of have this kind of comprehensible string of plans so that you can go up and down the Hudson and have a sense of linkage between these places. So Julie will be talking about Kingston, all the work they've done around their Weaving the Waterfront plan. And then Jeff, he's the director of land use and advocacy at Scenic Hudson. He's worked a lot on Beacon. Scenic Hudson's done a ton of work at Beacon, but he was also instrumental in trying to develop one of these plans called the Revitalizing Hudson Waterfronts Plan. And I think he'll talk about some of the challenges of, okay, we had this great plan. Now, how do we sort of get people to buy into it? Because everyone has their own sort of set of agendas. And I think why this particular event is going to be really informative for the Capital Region is that I feel like we're a little bit behind in activating our waterfronts in general. You know, Troy has some really cool, they just had that walkway and that seawall that they put in. Albany is grappling with its legacy of 787 and trying to figure out what to do with its waterfront. But I think looking a little bit down south to our neighbors will give us a lot of working models for what we can and what we should do and what's possible.
Something that I've thought about is once these waterfront spaces have been activated, do they become magnets for the elite? Are they no longer welcoming to everybody?
It's a really big question of, you know, all these kind of development projects, you know, and whether they're green or blue development projects, the specter of gentrification looms large, right? As soon as you beautify a brownfield zone or a formerly derelict waterfront, what happens to housing prices, rent prices, et cetera. I think it's a really good one. And it's one that cities which have long sort of abandoned and ignored their waterfronts need to grapple with. Like, okay, they're suddenly realizing this is valuable real estate. Who is it for? Is waterfront space now market rate housing? Is it public space? Is it a mixture of the two? And I think that's why this question of like, what do we do with our waterfronts? How do we bring people to the waterfronts is also a question of inclusion, right? What is the programming for? Is it, you know, is it a Latinx festival? Is it a farmer's market? Who are those audiences for those two kind of shows? How can we interweave them? So the programming aspect, I think, and who you're partnering with for the waterfronts becomes a big part of this question. How do we designate space that is inclusive for all and don't put up the kind of invisible fences that often accompanies some of these projects, right?
I think also what you were saying is a big part of if you revitalize a waterfront, then probably the housing around there, the lower income just gets pushed away. So it's not so much maybe about the welcoming of the area itself, but that certain demographics have them further to travel to actually visit these areas.
Yeah. And that's going to play out in really interesting ways in Troy, right? Because Lansingburg and South Troy, which, you know, are neighborhoods that have had a history of disinvestment, also have a ton of waterfront, right? So that's one of the assets of both those neighborhoods. So, you know, as we develop some of those neighborhoods, parts of those neighborhoods, how do we not displace? I think that's always the question. It's a huge question. And I think any sort of waterfront development, which includes residential areas, needs to have that affordable housing component be like the first step. The Albany Riverfront Collaborative, which is a group that's proposing boulevarding 787, in their sort of initial plans, which are not prescriptive, but more of like, look what could happen, there's 94 acres of space that's reclaimed from the highway. All those interchanges would be taken down. What do you do with those 94 acres? What goes in there? Is it green space? Is it climate resilient space? Is it public parks? Is it commercial space? Is it market rate housing? Is it affordable housing? So that figuring out that alchemy goes to the heart of what are the future of these cities.
Before we run out of time, there's a second event coming up, October 6th, Wind Shipped, a documentary that follows the low carbon sail freight schooner Apollonia. And I believe I learned about the schooner Apollonia in your focus lab. Isn't that right?
Yes. Yeah. We have a whole cabinet devoted to the Apollonia. I love this boat. I love this project in part because, you know, the Focus Lab show on waterfronts begins with sort of indigenous understandings of the watershed and of the tidal estuary, which, you know, the river was used as this sort of transportation corridor for indigenous peoples. They deeply understood the notion of the tides and the current. And while we use it as a transportation corridor during the age of industrialization, I think it was largely ignored as a sort of watershed. The Apollonia is a sail freight boat. So it moves goods, local goods, from the Hudson Valley down to New York City, completely using wind power. And then when they get to their port of call, they'll use a solar powered e-bike to transport goods like malt and cider and maple syrup and all kinds of really interesting, you know, local goods from the Hudson Valley to these farmers markets, including ones in the city. And, you know, there's the question of like, will this make a difference, right? Most freight is shipped by train, by truck primarily, and goes by the model of like, you know, overnight, right? You click on that button on Amazon, you get it the next day. Sam Merritt, who's the captain, is really positing the model of sail freight is we're going to take a little bit longer than a day, but we'll give back in many, many more ways. You know who's literally handling your freight. You know who we're going to call on. It's a transaction that's personal, that's low carbon, that's community driven, and that's embracing the Hudson River as the future highway. And so while there's one ship out there now, well, maybe a couple, there could be 100 that would be in direct sort of contrast to the kind of exploitative, you know, Amazon Prime model, right? So it's a really interesting ecological case study, freight case study, economic case study, community case study. The film is by John Bauermaster, who's a master filmmaker who's done a whole series of really interesting films on the Hudson River and environmental issues. He'll be there. So this is the Capital Region premiere. I really recommend it.
Thank you so much, Rafe Larson. futureofsmallcities.org is your website. And those events are taking place. The first, the conversation, is on
Tuesday, September 27th. And then the Windship screening, which is free but limited tickets, is on Thursday, October 6th.
Thank you so much for joining us, Rafe.
Thank you.
And the future of smallcities.org is their website. So with more information for these events and to follow what happens with future of small cities, go to their website. Thank you very much.
Arms of the Sea Theater co-founder and managing director Patrick Wadden talks with Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Andrea Cunliffe. They speak of the arts ensemble that fuses visual storytelling with live music and contemporary works of mask and puppet theater.
Arm of the Sea. They're bringing their production of Dirt, The Secret Life of Soil. It's a theatrical production with music, storytelling, and puppetry. I'm Andrea Cunliffe, speaking with Patrick Wadden, the co-founder and managing director of Arm of the Sea Theater, a Hudson Valley theater company.
How nice to hear your voice.
Likewise, Andrea.
How about if you just introduce yourself, because you are Arm of the Sea.
I am the co-founder and managing director of Arm of the Sea Theater, a mask and puppet theater company based in Saugerties, New York. We've been going 40 years and creating original works of contemporary mask and puppet theater with live music and performing in venues large and small, and community events, festivals, schools, conferences, bouncing over half of the countryside over the decades.
Yeah, you're coming to Troy on October the 8th at Freedom Square at 2:00. It's wonderful to have you come.
It's called Dirt, The Secret Life of Soil. Full title, Dirt, The Secret Life of Soil, and it's a deep dive into the teeming ecosystem right beneath our feet.
Sounds magnificent. I'm going to go back to the beginning. 40 years ago, you began doing mask and puppetry, bringing that kind of concept of theater to the public. What inspired you to do that?
Well, I had been working on the Clearwater Sloop for a number of years in the late 70s, and then in the early 80s, I proposed that we create a pageant, a puppetry spectacle that went along with their annual pumpkin sale, in which the sloop started in Albany and then spent 2 weeks sailing downriver, hosting pumpkin festivals at many towns along the way, ending up in New York City in the Halloween weekend. So Marlena Morallo came on board at that point, and a number of friends, including Al Nejma and others, summoned the crew of the Clearwater to be the performers and musicians. We created this piece that we performed every day at the festivals. That is really the genesis of Arm of the Sea. We take our name and the themes from a number of our shows from the Hudson as an estuary, as an arm of the sea.
Oh, brilliant. These people that you initially incorporated into this performance,
Hello.
Were they all actors?
Mm-hmm.
How did you somehow persuade the crew of the boat to become actors, to become performers, or were they already actors and performers?
Well, some of them were already musicians. Oh, it was, you know, the folks that work on the Clearwater have many talents and many interests. So it was not difficult to recruit people to bring to life this initial show. And then we went on to create other pieces. And by late in the 1980s, we had formed a company, and we started touring in the Hudson Valley. And then it's just gone on from there.
Your programs are normally socially oriented or have impact as far as what the environment or society in one way or another.
Yes, they draw on current events and current issues, and also offer a larger perspective. We try to offer an in-depth original perspective on current events and current issues. Yes.
When you began this, was your foundation for this social issues, or were you interested in entertaining, or how did the two get combined?
I think they got combined just doing it. Marlene and I, neither of us had studied or planned to do something like this. We just started out doing it and discovering that we had a knack for working together. And Marlene is, as the visual, the artistic director, really has the strength of her visuals have really become the hallmark of Arm of the Sea Theater.
And they're really amazing. You have enormous puppets at times. And are they puppets?
Well, we work in all kinds of things. I guess, you know, puppetry can be anything that is animated and represents something. So we integrate in our shows large-scale images and smaller images. And some are two-dimensional, some are three-dimensional. One of the fundamental powers or magic of visual theater is transformation and revelation. So we draw on those strengths of the form. And each show is a new discovery for us. We jump into subject matter and create new materials for it. And sometimes we go in with a certain idea of how the piece is going to be, and it changes in the process of making it, and it comes out different. So it's a process of discovery.
Your work is not necessarily oriented to a certain type of audience. You really appeal to the entire community in your productions.
We're interested in making work that can speak to a wide range of ages and walks of life, you know, people from many backgrounds. It looks very non-commercial. We are interested in offering this as, in a sense, an antidote to the 24/7 gush of electronic images that are being, you know, aimed at us in this time. So we are interested in creating a theater that looks very handmade, and it is not just handmade. It only comes to life by when it's brought to life by people. We have to perform it live. I mean, we have recorded some of our work, but our main mission is to present live performances, because it hits you in a different way than seeing film or video.
It was pretty tedious during COVID because you couldn't really perform much.
No, we were closed down for a year and a half, pretty much, during COVID. But, you know, we survived. We tightened our belts and we survived. We created two new pieces during that time, you know, in the studio. And then once we were able to start rehearsing together, we had new work to show, and we still are developing new work that came out of that unexpected, you know, sabbatical, you might say, during COVID.
It's remarkable how so many artists found that time to kind of reflect, and then they're all of a sudden emerging like an explosion. It's wonderful to see.
We have a long experience with performing outdoors, so we were able to start up performances and even this year do a number of performances, because indoor venues are slowly attracting audiences again, but the outdoor venues and festivals and community settings, arguably less COVID safer.
I'm looking forward to October the 8th. I think it's going to be exciting.
We should mention, Andrea, we will be at Freedom Square in Troy, and it's a space created by the Sanctuary for Independent Media, and we're really excited to be working with that organization. I have great admiration for what that group continues to create and develop in Troy.
So you're going to be there on October 8th at Freedom Square.
The story is a journey of discovery into the ecosystem beneath our feet. That's what it is. It's a journey. It's a kind of a magical journey of discovery into the realm of dirt.
That's great. We look forward to seeing you there. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Andrea.
This has been Andrea Conliff from the Hudson Mohawk Magazine speaking with Patrick Wadden, co-founder and managing director of Arm of the Sea Theater. And Arm of the Sea Theater has been seen in so many cities and towns up and down the Hudson Valley with their incredible and engaging and inspiring experimental hybrid performances, combining art and ecology and social action. That's totally inciting. So this program, Dirt, The Secret Life of Soil Production, will take place at Freedom Square. Well, it's a 2-minute walk from the sanctuary on October 8th at 2 o'clock.
To get a better look at theater in the region, we are now joined by Lee Strimbeck. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
Well, your life has been devoted to performing as well, hasn't it? And before we sort of dive into theater, can you give me some kind of a background on, or give our readers and our listeners some kind of a background of who you are and what your relationship is to theater? I think you're well known here in Troy.
Oh, well, thank you for that. My name is Lee Strimbeck. I have been devoted to theater since I was about 13. And I went to college to study dance and drama, which I ended up at NYU and stayed in New York City for 5 years. And then I moved to Sweden, like you do. And I learned the language and started performing in Swedish for a year. And then I came back and joined a professional ensemble in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, called the Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble. And I was there for a decade. And then eventually I found my way to upstate New York. I live in the Kinderhook area. And I have worked as an acting teacher for most of my career, as well as an actor, a director, and also a writer. Most recently, I wrote a one-woman show about Isabella Stewart Gardner, who built her own museum in Boston that opened in 1904. And I perform Isabella as well as having written the piece. And then when I can, I work, you know, I do voiceover work and film and stuff like that. So it really has been my whole career.
But Lee, you've just recently performed that, haven't you?
Yes, I did Isabella last year in the Berkshires once and twice for Gloucester Stage out in Gloucester, Massachusetts.
We need to bring you into Troy.
Yes.
Yes, we do.
I'm really proud of the piece, and I think it's a real feminist story. The fact that she did what she did at the turn of the century, the last century, is quite remarkable, because women weren't doing that. And even though there were a lot of people who had a lot of robber baron money, not all of them left something behind like she did, something that stands to this day. So, yes, I'm looking for places to do it. So
I'm learning a great deal about the remarkable women that have been in Troy and what we can and in the area that haven't been highlighted before. But let's get back to theater. You know, what makes, we've had a struggle during COVID, because actively coming into a venue and watching theater has been impossible. And it's just now kind of eking out. What can we do to help make theater more accessible?
The very first thing would be, and I don't know how to do this because I definitely know the cost of producing theater. And it's an intensive, expensive art form, but it's not accessible because it's too expensive. So I wanted to make sure that listeners here know that many of the theaters around here do a lot of, do some things to mitigate the cost. And one is, a lot of them have a pay what you will night. A lot of them have less expensive tickets, sometimes in previews or dress. And you can also usher and volunteer at a lot of these theaters, and you help people to their seats, and then you get a free seat of your own. So there are ways to see theater. I mean, I really, even as a person who's devoted to seeing as much live theater as I can, I can't see everything I want, because the cost, it can be just prohibitive. I think that's the main thing. And on a federal level, this country doesn't fund the arts well enough. I mean,
no, that's true.
If you work in Scandinavia, you go to some of these other countries where the arts are valued more, then you know people fly to London to see theater, partly because the ticket prices are more reasonable.
So, and even then they're not cheap.
And of course, that's people who can afford to fly to London. So
also then you can afford to support theater, for heaven's sake.
And there's also free Shakespeare in the Park. I just worked at Saratoga Shake. That's completely free.
We saw you there.
Thank you. And I know there's somebody in Pittsfield who does free Shakespeare in the Park. And I know there's Will Kemp.
Will Kemp Players in Troy. Yeah.
Yes. So there is free theater. And then the other thing to make it more accessible is to make it piece to, I think we go to theater to see mirrors of ourselves. And so I think we have to continue. There's an upheaval going on in the theater world in terms of, you know, for lack of a better word, diversity, telling stories from all points of view. You know, the last two big pieces I've seen were A Strange Loop on Broadway, which is a Black queer musical about a Black queer person making a Black queer musical. And you might think that a straight white woman like me going to see that would feel like I was excluded. But the genius of that, the beauty of that piece is that I felt parts of myself in that work. And then I was just at Berkeley Rep in San Francisco, and they're doing a musical called Goddess, which is about a Kenyan folktale about the goddess of music who wants to become a human so that she can experience human love. And it's set in a nightclub in Mombasa in Kenya. It's in Mombasa, and the nightclub's Moto Moto. And, you know, again, that's a universal story that happened to be performed by all Black actors with nine musicians in the pit. Mm-hmm. So I think that we can make theater more accessible by broadening the kind of stories we tell, because it has been predominantly for many, many years, you know, practiced by white theater practitioners with white people at the helm. So
But, you know, when you're talking about putting, you know, five musicians in the pit and, you know, singing and dancing, it is not something you can do on a shoestring, you know?
No, actually, Goddess is one of the biggest productions. I mean, Strange Loop is on Broadway, but it took 10 years to get there, as I understand it. But Goddess is one of the biggest musicals I've seen in a regional theater for a long time, since I saw On the Town at Barrington Stage, you know, yes.
Well, what do you,
enormous production.
What do you think we can do here locally? I'm really one for trying to bring theater into everyday life. You know, play readings are not that exciting, but they happen, and they're not, you know, that's a toughie. You know, independent filmmakers are doing stuff around. What can we do to kind of put a spotlight on the struggling theater companies that are trying to present?
I mean, the main thing is to try to go and see them. Like, that's the number one thing, is to show up. But I have long felt that one of the problems with theater is that it's in the evening. And anybody who works, you know, and I'm going to call it a so-called 9-to-5 job, because I think those don't exist anymore. I think people are working 7:30 to 6 or 8 a.m. to 10, you know, I mean, we're not working less, we're working more. And then you're saying, okay, now get a babysitter, now pay for parking, now come in, now see the show. I really think it would be super cool, I'm just going to put this out there, if we had lunchtime theater. And somehow we
could, yeah,
make plays in the places where people work and say, bring a sandwich, come hang out. We're going to do a half hour Hamlet for you. We're going to do a half hour devised theater work by the local high school students about the things that are on their minds. We're going to do an improv group and have a couple bites of your sandwich and then jump up and work with us. I mean, I think the time when theater happens and the cost of theater and who makes it are all things that could change and make it more accessible.
Well, Lee, I'm on board. You tell me what to do, I'm there. We're doing it. I mean, that's a sensational idea. You know, I'm desperate to see that we put a theater that's available to the community in a central location in Troy. And I'm talking about erecting a theater on the top of Prospect Park using the foundation of the old swimming pool.
There you go.
And putting a tent top on it and say, come on and entertain. Come on and play your instruments or sing with your choir or make it available for the community to practice theater.
I mean, look at Troy Foundry. I mean, Troy Foundry, yeah, during the shutdown did theater in alleyways and they did theater in abandoned buildings. And, you know, that's called site-specific theater. That doesn't necessarily make it more accessible if the theater company can't afford to keep ticket prices low or keep it at pay what you will.
So we need to get funding from government.
Yes.
No, well, that was a dream.
I was on the National Endowment for the Arts Theater Company panel for 5 years, and I was a site reporter, which meant I traveled all over the country to regional theaters for 3 years. And we just don't fund enough at a federal level. And those federal grants can be very small compared to the amount that it costs to run a theater company. But then your local banks will go, well, the National Endowment for the Arts, they stamped this company, and it can loosen funds. It's an imprimatur to loosen funds elsewhere. So until we have that kind of John F. Kennedy push again for the arts, I think it's going to continue to be really tough. And it shouldn't just be privately funded, because private funds can come and go, right? So some of the arts granting during COVID was very helpful. But my other reason, you know, I want to give people a reason to get up and go out and figure out how to come see theater. And that is because it's to be in a community and sit with other human beings and laugh and breathe and watch and observe. Is so marvelous. It's just not the same at all as sitting at home and watching. And there's so much brilliant television now. I mean, my goodness, but it's not the same as watching television by yourself or with one other person.
Well, when you're in a theater, when you're in a group feeling, you feel the same, you feel together. It's an exchange of emotion, I think, and it's wonderful collective.
And I feel like, you know, and it's true that, you know, the theater audiences are specific, the people who get up and out and see theater. But I've always been fascinated by the agreement that the lights will go down, the lights will come up on us, or we'll go to a separate area, which we call the performance area. And the audience agrees to suspend their disbelief and not walk onto that stage. And I just think that it's so magical. And I have had one person come up when I was performing in the Washington Square area in New York City, and he jumped up to hug me while I was doing Miss Lulubet. And I think there was, you know, there he was not necessarily mentally well, but it wasn't scary or anything. It just was somebody who, for whatever reason, was so overwhelmed that he had to jump up and hug me. But in all the years I've been in theater, that's never happened. So there's this agreement, and I think that there's something beautiful about going to a place where people are still agreeing on something, which is, even if I don't like this play, I'm gonna
yeah, you have other people who agree with you on that as well.
Yeah.
Lee, it's such a pleasure to have you with us. We'll see you again, I hopefully next month.
Lovely.
Will you come back? And let's have a rundown on what we can't miss in this autumn season.
I'll do my research on what's coming up in the area for sure.
You're terrific. Thanks for your help. Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that's our show. We hope you enjoyed the episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Jacob Boston. And my co-host is Andrea Cunliffe. Our engineer is Sina Bazila-Hickey. We thank all of our volunteers who made today's episode possible. Headlines from Mark Dunley, segment producer Mark Moses Nagel, Andrea, and your co-hosts Jacob, and once again, Andrea Cunliffe.
So we want to hear from you. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at mediasanctuary.org, or send us an email. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. We will be on a production break for the next 2 weeks to celebrate 5 years of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. We'll highlight our producers and archival content. For our extensive archive on our website, mediasanctuary.org, and follow along in the next 2 weeks to learn a bit more about the people behind the voices, who produce them, and some of the absolutely spectacular segments and programs that we've been producing over these past 5 years. So we appreciate your listening. So until next time, thanks for tuning in.